But I'll tell you, some misinterpretation of the Bible has really hurt the Jewish people over the years. We'll talk about it today.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, here we are. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. I've got a lot of stuff to talk to you about today. I want to take your calls, any Jewish-related calls you have, Jewish-related questions, 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-348-7884. Okay, where do I start? Let me start here. It's not a thoroughly Jewish emphasis so much, but let me start here. When I was in Singapore, I met with Pastor Joseph Prince for 2.5 hours. It was a private meeting. It was scheduled before I went over there. It was planned, but I could not announce it because it was a private meeting. And once we came to agreement about the meeting and what we could say publicly, now I could talk about it. Pastor Prince, known for his strong emphasis on grace, I've rejoiced in so much of his message but taken issue with other parts of his message. I quoted him often in my book, Hyper Grace. And we met for 2.5 hours. And as a result of that meeting, I then wrote an article saying, yeah, here are points of disagreement we have that remain, but here are points of agreement we have, and we both want to exalt God's true grace and expose counterfeit grace. So you can read about that. My article is up, my meeting with Pastor Joseph Prince. You can read about it on charismanews.com. But if you're connected with us on Facebook or Twitter, we have sent out word about that. So I believe that you'll be edified to read this, encouraged to read it. The article was written by me, then he gave edits on his end. We went back and forth until we were 100% in harmony. So this article is released with his full blessing and approval. I encourage you to read it and share it with others. But if you didn't hear the news, one of the last things that happened in the administration of President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry is that they stealthily released $221 million to the Palestinian Authority. Now, I've mentioned this in the week already, but I want to say it again because it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I'm all for helping the Palestinians, but it is well known that the leadership is very corrupt, Hamas even more so than Palestinian Authority, that when money goes to Hamas for support of Palestinians, a lot of it actually goes to build weapons, weapons manufacturing, and building tunnels to go under Israel to try to perpetrate terrorist attacks. And very little goes to the people for rebuilding the cities and things like that and building up the infrastructure. With the Palestinian Authority, a lot goes into propaganda. There's other parts that go to aid and abet terrorism, and other parts go into the pockets of the leadership. Same with Hamas. This is the last thing that we should have been doing. Well, we've now heard that Donald Trump froze that money. When he came into office and heard about it, he froze that money. Good for him. I also read that his staff, White House staff, I don't know how many, they would be marching in the pro-life march this week, the memorial of Roe v. Wade. That, again, is positive. And Nikki Haley, who was now sworn in as the ambassador to the U.N., former governor of South Carolina, has said, yes, she supports moving the American embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. So while it hasn't happened yet, it would be too quick for it to happen, I have every reason to believe that it will happen. I want to talk about Bible interpretation with you, a podcast I just did yesterday and some real differences I had with the interviewer. A bunch of other things we'll talk about today. Some connection with Islam and the women's march, the protest against Donald Trump, all coming your way. Get on the phone now. Give us a call, 866-34-TRUTH.
God of light, hear our cry, sympathize.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
He is my defense, I shall not be moved. He is my defense, I shall not be moved.
Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown, your Thoroughly Jewish host, with your Jewish questions, 866-34-TRUTH. That's the number to call. Before I go to your calls, let me talk to you about a podcast interview I did yesterday. There are lots and lots of podcasts, growing numbers of podcasts. I wish I could take every request to do them. But I was asked to do one particular podcast, and the host, I'm not going to mention the name, the host holds to a preterist view, which says that the prophecies about the return of the Lord, the coming of the Lord, the end of the age in the New Testament, that they're referring to the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70. And when it pertains to Israel, that that's when God forever finished dealing with Israel as a nation. No more dealing with Israel as a nation. Individual Jews can be saved, but no more dealing with Israel as a nation. So the return of the Jewish people to the land today would not be considered prophetic in any way. And the idea that there'll be a future turning of the Jewish people would not be believed by many in the preterist camp, because those would be national promises. And while there are some positive aspects of preterism, namely the recognition of the significance of the destruction of the temple in the year 70, and the idea of a post-millennial view that sees the triumph of the kingdom of God on earth, so it has a positive outlook in terms of the spread of the gospel, I find there to be very, very severe errors with which I categorically differ. And those that are the most extreme in the preterist position will even say the resurrection of the dead is a spiritual thing, that there is not a future physical resurrection, or that we're already in the new heavens or new earth, or extreme views like that. Well, I have no problem being on a show where someone's going to differ with me. It's no problem whatsoever. I have a problem when bizarre interpretations are put forward that then undermine hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of other verses, all right? And a simple principle that if something comes later, it can't undo the plain meaning of that which came before it. And you can't claim that they are then in harmony or the same voice. What do I mean? That if Jesus claims to be the Messiah and then undoes everything that came before him and abolishes the law or the prophets and says he's done with this and it no longer exists, or he renounces the God of the Old Testament or something like that, well, then he's obviously not the fulfillment of those promises. Hence, Deuteronomy 13 tells you if someone comes working miracles and giving prophecies or dreams and they come to pass, but their messages follow other gods, then don't follow them. The same way Jesus warns in the New Testament about counterfeit messiahs and false prophets and things like that, false Christs, false prophets, he warns. So if someone comes today and says, I am Jesus, don't believe them. Doesn't matter if they have fire coming out of their mouth, don't believe them. Doesn't matter if they point at the wall and the wall explodes, don't believe them. Right? So he's warned us in advance. So I have a real problem, friends, with any system of interpretation that systematically undoes what comes before. So you have, for example, the promises about the Jewish people in the land. You say, well, no, the land, that's just pointing to Jesus. It's a spiritual truth. No, it's not just a spiritual truth. It has to do with where people live. It has to do with the place from which they were exiled and the place to which they'll return. And on it goes. So I did have a very strict schedule. A half hour is a lot of time for me to do on a podcast. I told the gentleman I'll do the half hour, and I literally had to go exactly at that minute. I had to get up and go to another appointment. So when we got to a half hour, I said, hey, we're done. I've got to go. And he wanted to press an interpretation, and I was real firm with him. I mean, it's a bit contentious. I was real firm with him. He wanted to press that Zechariah 12, which speaks about all nations coming against Jerusalem, and explicitly speaks of the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the inhabitants of Judah and the attack of the nations. And Zechariah 14 speaks about it. And then God delivering the people of Judah and Jerusalem at that time as they look to him whom they've pierced. And then Zechariah 14 talking about what God establishes out of that and his reign on the earth. And this is when the Messiah returns and his feet come down on the Mount of Olives, as prophesied in Acts 1, that the same Jesus, the way he left, he'll return. So he's trying to argue, based on an obscure interpretation, that it's fulfilled in the book of Esther, that Zechariah 12 and 14 are fulfilled in the book of Esther. It's complete nonsense. And when he wanted to argue the point, I said, I have to go. My half hour time is up. I've got to get to an appointment. And he wanted to argue the point. I said, we're done. We're done. I've got no place for that. And for someone to argue, well, the reason that most readers of the Bible, the vast majority of readers of the Bible in history, and vast majority of Bible scholars and Bible teachers throughout the centuries have never seen this alleged connection between Zechariah 12, Zechariah 14, and the book of Esther, is because we're using a wrong system of interpretation. That's bogus. That's bogus. So here, real simple. If God says something over and over hundreds of times, and now we see how it is lived out, you will be exiled from the land. You will return to the land. I've made a covenant with you for 1,000 generations about the land. You're not coming back because of your righteousness, but because my name is being blasphemed, God says. And I'm going to bring you back to the land, your unbelief, and sprinkle clean water on you. When you have that over and 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 over. And then Jesus tells us in Luke's gospel that the Jewish people of Jerusalem would be scattered in the nations until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So there's a scattering until. What does it mean? There's a regathering, all right? You will be sick until that medicine takes effect, meaning you will be sick until the medicine takes effect and you are better. You will be paying off your debt for 10 years until you've eliminated it, after which it's not there. You will be scattered in the nations until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, at which point you're no longer being scattered in the nation. Self-evident meaning there. And then Paul reiterating that even though the Jewish people are now enemies because of the gospel, they are loved because of the Father's sake, because of the patriarchs, for the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. So the promises God made, he's going to keep. You say, well, every promise of God is fulfilled in Jesus. Oh, in terms of God bringing to pass what he's promised through the cross, yes. But that doesn't mean that if God spoke of exile and regathering, there's no longer regathering. One debate I did, a friendly debate, a good scholarly brother, Gary DeMar, you can watch it just by going or listen to the debate by going to thelineoffire.org and just type DeMar, D-E-M-A-R. I think you'll find he made some excellent points. We had excellent dialogue, and it's friendly and good spirit. I think you'll learn from it. But one point to which I took strong exception was the idea that God scattered the Jewish people physically and will regather them spiritually only. I do not see Scripture saying that. The one conclusion I came to while writing my doctoral dissertation on the Hebrew word for healing and its ancient Near Eastern context was that the literality of the healing had to equal the literality of the smiting. For example, if God smite and destroyed a people so that their economy is broken, their buildings are destroyed, the people are in exile, there's sickness and disease and poverty as a result of the sin of the people, and God says, I'll restore you, well, that means the opposite of all that happened. It would mean the people return, the buildings built up, again, health and prosperity. It would be the opposite. So in the midst of a debate, which I think you'll find to be excellent, and it wasn't a formal debate as much as a back and forth, but I think you'll find it to be helpful, edifying. I think you'll learn a lot, both from Dr. DeMar and from me in terms of our interaction. But again, a point to which I took strong exception was this idea that when God says, I will scatter you and I will regather you, that the scattering was physical and the regathering is spiritual in Jesus. Yes, there will be a spiritual regathering as well, but you better believe there's a physical regathering. And I'm going to put this out and then going to go to your calls. I put this out over and over in public debate setting, social media, radio. So to millions of people, we've put this out, and I've yet heard one solid answer. When God blesses, no one can curse. When he curses, no one can bless. When he opens the door, no one can shut it. When he shuts the door, no one can open it. When he smites, no one can heal. When he heals, no one can smite. When he scatters, no one can regather. When he regathers, no one can scatter. If, in fact, God scattered the Jewish people in his wrath, in judgment, as partial preterists and full preterists and others would say, and as I would say, as he scattered our people in judgment, we don't have the power to regather ourselves. How then are there more than 6 million Jews living in Israel today, a reconstituted modern state of Israel against all odds and out of the ashes of the Holocaust? If God didn't do it, how did it happen? Somebody tell me. I still haven't gotten an answer yet. I don't believe there is one. I believe it's simple. God did it. Back with your calls.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thank you for joining us on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, 866-34-TRUTH. So my article on my meeting with Pastor Joseph Prince is going viral. Just been up for a few hours and shared over 8,500 times already just on one website. But that ties in with our special offer, our special resource offer of this week. Just so happens that it does, about grace, about liberty, about walking in the freedom of the Lord, about dangers of counterfeit grace, hyper grace. So check that out on thelineoffire.org to find out more. And if you don't get my emails, please sign up to receive my emails. The beginning of every week, we'll let you know about a greatly discounted resource offer that'll be a real blessing to you. Sometimes we'll share some testimonies and other things midweek. And then the end of the week, every article I've written, every video we put out through the week, which can be 6, 8, 10 different resources. Maybe you missed some of them. We'll give you a synopsis of each of them. And this way, just click on it, share it with others. We can be a blessing to you and minister to you. So if you don't get my emails, by all means, go to thelineoffire.org and sign up for our email list. All right, let's go to the phones. We'll start with our friend in Washington, D.C., Charlie. Welcome back to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Welcome back to the United States. I just wanted to pick off from 2 weeks ago on Psalms 110. So I wanted to start with verse 1. Could you please just clarify particularly why, you know, it demands to be understood as fighting battles from heaven instead of earth, and even, you know, sitting at my right hand, why that doesn't mean just ruling as a king or ruling as a representative instead of a literal ascension, considering the fact that, you know, maybe weren't all David's enemies under subjection to him by the time he died?
Yeah, well, the first question is, when else does God ever ask anyone to sit at his right hand? Never. In other words, the best image that you would have is the Lord being by our right hand, backing us, would be an extraordinary image, which you have, for example, in Psalm 16, you know, the Lord at my right hand. But this is exceptional language. It's unusual language. And when you look as it's going on, it's crushing kings, judging nations, crushing leaders over the entire world. That never happened in David's reign. No matter how much hyperbole you have, he did not have an empire like Egypt at its biggest, or Babylon or its biggest, or Syria at its biggest. He subdued some of the neighboring states, which are all, you know, relatively small. So there's no application that fits in his day. Again, it's speaking of something far beyond anything that happened during his reign. And therefore, the word sit at my right hand being quite unique, God saying sit at his right hand, and it's a worldwide dominion he's to have. It's quite logical and natural to understand it in terms of a heavenly ascension. Now, when it was originally spoken, how was it understood? That could be debated. Was there full insight into it? Remember, Peter tells us that the prophets, when they prophesied, didn't understand everything initially and asked God what were they saying, because things they expected to happen didn't happen. Okay, so what are we actually saying? And God showed them that some of what they were saying was not for them, but for the future generations when the Messiah came. But the language of the psalm as a whole is far, far beyond anything in the reign of David. I mean, you're talking about the nations. You're talking about India. You're talking about China. You're talking about the rest of the inhabited world. That never happened. So
right. But I guess, like, for example, you know, when you look at the powers that surrounded David and him being successful, you know, why does the word for world have to be understood as worldwide? Because there are other passages in the Bible that talk about world but don't necessarily include everyone.
Well, the question would be, how else are you going to say it? Again, start here. Show me anywhere where someone is invited to sit at God's right hand. God is always pictured as ruling and reigning in a heavenly place. The most natural interpretation is a heavenly ascension. That's the first thing. Otherwise, God could be at your right hand backing you on the earth. But to sit at God's right hand is extraordinary language. We don't want to downplay it. Just because we may be familiar with it, we don't want to downplay it. That's one thing. The other question is, how else could God have said this any more clearly? All right, it's over nations, and it's over much, much land. So I'm just looking at different translations. The end of verse 6, crushing heads far and wide. He'll shatter heads throughout an extensive territory. He'll shatter heads over the whole earth. The Hebrew is a unique expression there, just a vast amount of land. So how else is God going to say it? I mean, you keep wanting to downplay and narrow it, but you're violating the language here, which is extreme.
Right, right. Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. I just have one more quick question.
Yes, go for it.
What you're referring to with the exalted language. You know, one could possibly look at 1 Chronicles 29, verse 20 as a cross-reference for, you know, maybe something that you could kind of equivocate to that, or even maybe Psalms 45. So why is it possible, even when we look at the word for Elohim, is it possible to exalt the king to the highest level? And I guess if you could just expand upon the significance of using Elohim as an acceptable term, also in context of what you were saying.
Yeah, what using Elohim would actually make one wonder was the king being considered divine on any level. You know, it would raise a question. Psalm 45, Kisach Elohim l'olam va'ed, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. Your throne, O Elohim, is forever and ever. Now, it immediately then says, your Elohim, your God. So it's making clear, okay, there is a God over this Elohim. And yet H.J. Krauss, one of the top Psalms commentators of the last generation, a German scholar, he translated it and then into English, O Divine One. So, you know, it is very highly exalted language, and it could only be fulfilled in the Messiah. As for passages that speak of parallel obeisance for the king and the Lord, as you mentioned, 1 Chronicles 29:20, and I detail a lot of these in Volume 2 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, it's to do obeisance to. So they bow down before the Lord and before the king. But that, again, points to the fact that the even more highly exalted king, the Davidic king to come, would be all the more worthy of that worship and exaltation. So, again, I understand how highly exalted the king was, but the language is only fulfilled in the coming of the Messiah. So all for your probing questions, they're fair. And they're good. I think if you go through carefully Volume 2 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, the first four objections, that'll help further sort this out for you. Friends, I'm staying around for another 90 minutes. Keep listening on thelineoffire.org if you lose me on your radio. I'm going right back to the phones when we come back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Shouts! Shouts of joy and victory resound in the tents of the right.
Thanks so much for joining us on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. My delight to be with you. 866-348-7884. May I just mention something about Donald Trump? Not Jewish related, but I want to mention this. Everyone I know that has met with him privately, and then in Singapore, I spoke with a friend of a close friend of his, and they all say the same thing about one-on-one, how focused he is, how attentive he is, how humble he is, how gracious he is, and that he seems to be a different person. Some of his public campaigning and things like that seem to be very different person. And why was that? And obviously that public person can be more of a divisive figure. And obviously it was strategic in terms of how he acted, whether you like it or not. But what's happening now is he's doing a lot of behind-the-scenes meeting with congressional leaders, with CEOs, with executives. Some referred to it as a charm offense. So it's interesting that perhaps behind the scenes, as much as he's going to hold to his strong views, he'll be...
All right, friends, this is Michael Brown. I am sitting here in the pitch black. Our power has gone out through our entire building. And so in the middle of my sentences there, suddenly everything went dead. But the beauty of live radio is I can call in and continue the broadcast. So my apologies for that dead air time. But JJ, if we have a guest, I can't see anything, but I can certainly hear. And that's all I need to do for radio right now. If you could bring on our next guest, you pick the line and bring them on. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yeah, talk about it. I got to call into my own radio show. This is Michael Brown. I'm glad to be with you on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. The power is out in our building. We have a laptop that I'm using that has 16% battery on it, where I can at least see the screen and see who's calling. So we are right back on top of it with you here on the Line of Fire on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. And I'm going to go back to the phones and start with Pastor Eric again in Chicopee, Massachusetts. Welcome back to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. It's great to talk to you. Glad to hear your trip to Singapore was successful. I was praying for you while you were gone, and it's really
Thank you.
To have you back.
Thank you so much.
Amen. My question is, something came up actually in church recently, and it's something that I've encountered pretty frequently, and I think mostly in Pentecostal circles. And somebody spoke and was talking about Satan, Lucifer specifically, you know, the term used, being at one time the worship leader of heaven, the source of music in heaven, and actually get into a pretty elaborate discourse about, you know, that when we worship, that we cause him pain, and, you know, really detailed. And so, of course, you know, myself here, I'm not the lead pastor, my brother is, but, of course, we're discussing this, and this seems to all come, this concept seems to come from Ezekiel, where in Ezekiel 28, it speaks of the king of Tyre, and he's described as having been Eden of God, covered with many precious stones. And then the specific part I want to ask you about is verse 13, verse 13 and 16, but it says in the King James, it says, the workmanship of your timbrels and pipes were prepared for you on the day you were created. Sorry, that's New King. The King James is very similar. And it seems to be that one passage that most attached this idea to, that Satan was the worship leader of heaven. Thanks to you, I own the Cultural Background Study Bible. Mm-hmm. And he makes a distinction there that I think is important also, that this passage speaks of a cherub, which would be distinct from an angel. So could you comment on this for me?
Sure thing. I appreciate it. Appreciate the question. Ezekiel 28 is an extraordinary passage because it does speak of the king of Tyre being judged. And then it seems to go beyond that to speak of some heavenly being that was cast down, that was in the garden of God, that was cast down. And I believe that is a right interpretation in terms of saying that is Lucifer, Satan. Isaiah 14, speaking of the fall of Babylon, then speaks of the fall of this exalted being, the shining one, son of the dawn, and shining one in Latin is Lucifer, light bearer, and hence how Satan gets the name Lucifer. But I do believe these passages take us behind the scenes, and I do believe then that this is speaking about Satan. However, you're 100% right to say that we're going way beyond the evidence to say that he was the worship leader in heaven. Somehow there was an extraordinary association of music with him. The fact that he's spoken of as a cherub, a guardian cherub, as opposed to just an angel. As I understand it, that's just one type of angel, just like a seraph is another type of angelic being. So that part wouldn't trouble me. But I do believe that we go way too far, sir, in saying that Satan was, quote, the worship leader of heaven. Is it possible he was? Yes. Is he associated with music? Definitely. Could that be why Satan uses music so powerfully as a tool? Could be. Or it could just be that he observes the power of music and uses it, but could well be that he knew the power of music before human beings were ever created. All of that is very, very possible. But what you're saying, that, you know, we worship God, it hurts him. If it hurts him, it's just because Jesus is being exalted, and that's against him. And if there is something to it, someone has a spiritual insight, maybe. But can you deduce it from this text? Certainly not. We're going way too far with that type of teaching and emphasis.
Can I ask you a quick follow-up?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, from that same passage, now, again, in the King James, the New King James, both, again, at the end of verse 13, reference the workmanship of his timbrels and pipes. However, in the modern translations, for instance, in the ESV, that same verse says, you know, after it just the engravings and the jewels, then it says, and crafted in gold were your settings and your engraving. So I'm wondering if you can give some insight into the Hebrew words that are used there, because, you know, settings and engravings versus the timbrels and pipes, you know, that timbrel and pipe, that seems to be more the connection that people make to music. But the modern translations seem to take a very different tack on it, describing it, again, as a setting and an engraving.
Right, and sometimes there are terms that are a little ambiguous, and that the different interpreters will look for the best understanding they have, or based on ancient manuscripts, things like that. You mentioned the Cultural Study Bible, and so, for example, the specific verse you were pointing to here in Ezekiel 28 was the one you were just referencing.
Verse 13.
Right. So NIV, you were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone adorned you, carnelian, chrysolite, and emerald, topaz, onyx, and jasper, lapis, lazuli, turquoise, and beryl. Your settings and mountings were made of gold. On the day you were created, they were prepared. Yeah, so of course, that reading of the text would absolutely disassociate any reference to music there whatsoever. And again, it's just a matter of the King James having one understanding of the Hebrew text. And what we'll do, as our power is coming back on, in the building now, and I'll have the Hebrew text in front of me. I have lots of passages memorized and some not, so I've just got to look at this afresh. If you keep listening, a little bit later in this hour, I'll review the text again in Hebrew and explain why the King James had that understanding versus these other texts. But when you see a bunch of modern translations consistently going in a different direction, and when they come from, you know, little different traditions and backgrounds, that tends to tell you that something then is amiss in the earlier translation. Hey, I appreciate the call, and again, for sure, we're going way beyond the text in making some of these statements. 866-34-TRUTH. You know, when I was first saved, I would hear these interpretations or some preacher say something, and I thought, wow, I didn't know that was in the Bible. I guess I just have to keep studying and learning. I didn't know that was there. And then I kept to study and learn, realize it's really not there. It's really something that people are reading into the text or just some traditional interpretation that they had. Let's go to Jason in Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. This is my first time calling. I just moved to this area to get your station not too long ago, and appreciate all you did at the Brownsville Revival. I attended that several times. Gerald from Tennessee, and you actually prayed for me a time or two. But
well, wonderful.
Yeah. What I was wanting to ask, being this is the Jewish, you know, Jewish questions and things about how the Jews relate to Christianity, is, you know, I support Israel. It bothers me when our government pressures them to give up land. I have a shofar Israeli flag, but I do feel like the Lord kind of stopped me from going too far into it. I went to a conference that was a Messianic conference, and you know, I had people that were there giving me these, you know, kind of supposed tracts about why I needed to go to church on Saturday and what have you. And I felt the Lord kind of put a check on me, saying you could go too far into this. And the way I feel, you know, because you said there's all these scriptures over and over and over and over again. Well, I feel the same way that, you know, Christ is the cornerstone that the builders have rejected, and in my opinion, still are rejecting them. And the New Testament says that all these things that were done were like shadows, but Christ is the real. And you know, a shadow can only mimic the real. The real doesn't mimic the shadow. My point is, being to get to the specific questions and scriptures is, you know, the biggest verse that people have in my studying this of the New Covenant was when they said, you know, when Jesus said, think not that I've come to destroy the law, but to fulfill it. And, you know, Paul says in Romans 10:4 that specifically says Christ is the end of the law for those that believe him unto righteousness.
Or it could also be translated, is the end goal of the law. Tell you what, we got a break, if you could just sharpen the question you want to ask, and when we get back on the other side of the break, we'll go right back to that. All right, thank you for your call.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Our power is back on in our building. Got everything rebooted. My screen's up. I've got the Bible in front of me in multiple languages. Oh, we are rolling. 866-34-TRUTH on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. All right, so Jason and Charlotte, your specific question that you were building to, sir.
Yeah, so my question would be, you know, based on the book of 1 John, it says, he that has the Son has life, he that has not the Son has not life, as he believed not the record. What advantage are we saying that a Jewish person would have now, post-cross, being that the cross puts everyone on an equal playing field? What's the advantage that they have if they don't have life? And it's not to be discriminate towards the Jews.
No.
What one up would they be? What would be the purpose of it?
There would be more accountability. It's not a one up. It's not a one down. Romans 2 says that that God's favor and blessing will come to everyone who does good, the Jew first and also the Gentile, and his judgment will come on everyone who does evil, the Jew first and also the Gentile. In ancient days, when only the Jewish people had the scriptures and knew about the God of Israel, they had that advantage, and Paul speaks of it in Romans 3, that the oracles of God were committed to them. But since the cross and the national rejection of the Messiah, a hardness in part has happened to Israel. So there's a remnant saved in every generation, but there's a hardness on the people as a whole when it comes to the gospel. So we're 100% equal at the foot of the cross. Romans 10 says the same God is richly answers all who call on him, Jew and Gentile. In faith, in the Lord, there's no caste system or class system. So as I'm a Jew, you're a Gentile, we are equally sons of God, equally priests to God, equally branches of the vine, equally members of the body. However, there are distinct callings that God gives to Jewish people and to the people of the nations, just like a man is different than a woman, even though we're equal in the Messiah. So I believe there's a certain spiritual responsibility that Jewish people have, and that there is a certain role that we have in the earth to fulfill, and it can be for better or for worse. But that being said, there's no specific advantage in that respect. The Jewish people have the Hebrew scriptures, but they would especially be studying Jewish tradition and the things that surround it, and that tradition would not point them to the Messiah. So I would say, rather than advantage or a one-up, I would just say greater accountability, for better or worse, and the gospel is to the Jew first and also to the Gentile. Jason, I think you did well to keep your love for Israel and have a heart for the Jewish people without getting pulled in to this idea that you have to be Jewish or live Jewishly to be more spiritual. I think that was a right pulling back on your end, sir. Hey, I appreciate the call. 866-34-TRUTH. And welcome to Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, back to Pastor Eric's question about Ezekiel 28:13. The workmanship of thy tabrets and thy pipes was prepared in thee in the day thou wast created. The New King James says the workmanship of your timbrels and pipes. HCSB, your mountings and settings. ESV, your settings and your engravings. NIV, your settings and mountings. NET, your settings and mounts. NLT, all beautifully crafted for you and set in the finest gold. Complete Jewish Bible. Let's see, your pendants and jewels. The New Jewish Publication Society version. Gold beautifully wrought for you. The Septuagint understands it as not related to music. So where did the King James get this from as I'm looking at the text? Okay. So the word tof is timbrel or tambourine, and you have tupecha, which they understood as your tambourines. And then the word that follows, nekev, has to do with maybe sockets, something like that, something to do with the jeweler's work. They took it as something hollowed out and based on the previous word, took it to be musical. Is it possible? It's possible, but it's unlikely. So let's just say that the certainty of connecting this guardian cherub spoken of in Ezekiel 28, connecting him with music, that it is questionable at best. All right, do I have time for another call? I think so. Let's go to Edison in Chesterfield County, Virginia. Welcome to the Line of Fire. Time is short, so dive right in.
Okay, Dr. Brown, thank you so much for having me. I love you. But we're going to go straight to Acts chapter, this would be Acts 17, 10 and 11. It talks about, and the brother immediately sent away Paul, Silas, by night into Berea, as they were having a problem over this other synagogue, as you well know. And it says these were more noble than those in Thessalonica. They received the word by all readiness of mind and searching scriptures daily to see if these things were so. And I think what you're doing is wonderful, because it is, we're searching the scriptures to see if these things are so, but I also believe that God was able to write the word, I mean, deliver the word, had the word written. As you know, he wrote the first bit of the Bible. He gave the commandments, literally by the finger of God. And I believe he's able to put the men, the right men in place, to substantiate his word and to keep it solid, and as well as the Jews being blind, and later grafted into the into the body of Christ. What say you, sir?
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, God has a plan. And even though we sin and we grieve him as human beings, the fact is, it says in Ephesians 1 that he works everything according to the counsel of his will. So he has a plan. Things are going somewhere. And he ultimately will have a people of the fullness of the nations and the fullness of Israel turning to him and serving him as the one true God and enjoying him and his presence forever. One interesting thing about the Berean Jews, more noble in spirit than the Thessalonian Jews, when Paul came and said, I've got news about the Messiah, their first reaction was not, that's stupid, you're crazy, there's no way. Their first reaction was, wow, that would be wonderful. We would love it to be true. We would love it to be true that the Messiah has come, but let's examine, let's see what the scriptures say. So in my mind, sir, just to add one comment to where you started us, a Berean spirit, when you come and say, hey, God is moving in this city, there's a great outpouring, people are being wonderfully touched, your first reaction is not, oh, yeah, right, sure, oh, yeah, I'll believe, yeah, prove it to me, go ahead, prove it to me. Your first reaction is, man, that'd be wonderful. We're praying for that very thing, but let's see if it's really God. Let's see if it's genuinely the Lord, and if it's scriptural and lives are being touched. So it's that attitude with which we go to the Word that distinguishes a Berean attitude from a non-Berean attitude. May we all be Bereans in that respect. Thank you, Edison. Hey, friends, we've got a bunch of new videos, new articles on the Line of Fire website. Check it out, and check out our special resource offer that'll be a great blessing to you. My bottom line today, the word liberates, the word sets free. Live in the freedom of God. But I'll tell you, some misinterpretation of the Bible has really hurt the Jewish people over the years. We'll talk about it today.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey, friends, it is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. As always, my joy to be with you. I've got a little extra joy today. The reason being, I'm just glad to be on the air. We had a power outage earlier. We were meeting with our entire staff and team, and we don't normally all get together in this way, so we're praying together, and I was just sharing vision with them as we're starting the year. And all of a sudden, the power went out, and Matt, my producer, said, yeah, he noticed the Duke Energy, which is the power company in our area, noticed the Duke Energy truck on the street, and then we found out power would be out until 2:30 our time. We're on the East Coast, so we're trying to figure out, okay, how are we going to do the broadcast without power? So I was just going to call in on my cell phone because even our regular phones are connected to a whole power system and wouldn't work otherwise. So we're all set to do that, and the power went back on. So we're great. They got the work done earlier. We're moving along. Everything's great. And what was it? Like just about a half hour ago, boom, I'm sitting here in the dark. No computer, no nothing, no power, no connection to the studio. As I'm broadcasting in one place, our engineering and phone answering are in another place, and that's how it's all done. Even if it was all in here, all the power went out. So I quickly called in to my own show. That was the only way to reconnect. And then in the midst of that, power went back on. So I'm glad to be looking at my computer screen, got my Bible in multiple languages up there, can look at all of you that are calling in. So I'm going to go to your call shortly. Any Jewish-related question of any kind you have, Phone lines are open, 866-34-TRUTH. So tell me what you think of this, all right? Let's say you're the Smith family, all right? Smith family. And I make a promise to you. I own the property in which you live. And I say, hey, I am giving this to the Smith family for all generations. You now own this property from here on. And whether we're in good relationship or bad relationship, it doesn't matter. This is your property, period, for good. And I'm giving it to you. And then something happens. You do something that upsets me. And you go away for a few days and you come home and there are other people living on the property. In fact, they even have their name up and they say the New Smith family. And you recognize them. That's the Jones family. And you come to me and you say, hey, you made a promise to me that no matter what, that's my property. Even if we didn't have a good relationship, now I do one thing that upsets you and you give it to someone else. And I say, no. The Jones family is now the Smith family. Would you consider that duplicitous? Would you consider that dishonest? Would you consider that deceptive? Would you consider that wrong, unethical? Yes. Of course you would. But that's a lot of people say God did. That he said, the church is now Israel. Yeah, I made promises to Israel, and I made promises that no matter what, I'm going to keep these promises. And yeah, there's a Sinai covenant with blessing and curses, but before that, there's the promise that God made to Abraham. And Paul writes in Galatians that the law, which is 430 years after the promise, cannot nullify the promise. God made these promises, and then through the prophets, he reiterated that no matter what Israel did, he would preserve Israel as a nation. He would preserve his people. And although he scattered them to the ends of the earth, he would bring them back because of his faithfulness, not their faithfulness. And now people say, no, actually the church is Israel. And there are no promises that remain for the nation of Israel, including the land of Israel. That's bogus. It's only bogus. It's destructive. And through history, it opened the door for what we call replacement theology or supersessionism, that the church has now superseded Israel, replaced Israel in God's economy and God's plan of salvation. And it opened the flood of anti-Semitism in the church against Jewish people through the centuries. And some of it still exists to this day. We'll be right back with your Jewish-related calls on Jewish Thursday.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Make me glad by your deeds, O Lord, so I sing for joy at all your hands have made. How great are your works, O Lord, Elohim Baruch Hashem.
Friend Paul Wilbur singing brings joy to my heart on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday or any day of the week. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-378-7884. One more point about interpretation, and then I'm going to take some calls. Okay, if you have a description of a building with walls and ceilings and carpets and floors and windows and all of this, And you're looking at a blueprint laying that out, would it be more logical to think that that's an actual blueprint of a building or to think that that's a picture of an NFL football team? So obviously, it's a building. Okay. So when the Old Testament speaks about specific literal things in specific literal ways and goes into detail, isn't it more logical to take it as meaning what it says than to put a spiritual interpretation on it? It's not to say that you can't make a spiritual application, but you do not want to spiritualize away the literal. And you say, yeah, well, when Jesus comes, it all changes. Well, no, that can't be. Everything he did is built on the foundation of what came before. And even says in Romans 3 that faith establishes the law. It doesn't do away with it. It puts it in a proper place and establishes it. So another building question. When you build a house, you lay the foundation, then you say it's two-story, you build the first floor, then you build the second floor. Once you build the second floor, do you now knock the first floor out? No, the second floor is built on the first. So in the same way, the old saying that the New Testament is the Old Testament revealed and the Old Testament is the New Testament concealed, these are truths. And one builds on the other. It does not tear down, abolish, or negate. You say, no, we're just having a spiritual insight. You know, John the Baptist, John the Immerser, he wasn't really Elijah, but Jesus said he was. Well, it's the spirit and power of Elijah in which he came. He was not Elijah incarnate. He came in the spirit and power of Elijah, and it could be that there'll be a literal Elijah before the age is done. We don't know that. But was the Messiah born in Bethlehem? Was it prophesied to be born in Bethlehem? Yes. Was he born of a supernatural birth? Yes. Did he literally die? Yes. Did he literally rise? Yes. So all the fundamental things he literally did. Let's not spiritualize away the clear teachings of the Hebrew Scriptures. All right, let's go to Mark in North Carolina. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Michael Brown, it's an honor to speak to you again. I got my fiance a book that you and Nancy had wrote on diet, and she's enjoying it and going through it. And we were praying for you and your team as y'all left and went to Singapore. We're glad that you're back, and I've been looking forward to you getting back on the Line of Fire. So I'm going to be real quick with my question. Hopefully you can understand where I'm coming from since it's thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
You got it.
I know how much I go through on a daily basis. I love the Lord, and I've been walking with the Lord for a while, but sin is inevitable. So when I look at the Mosaic times and I see when Moses led his people out of captivity from Egypt, that God had a whole bunch of offerings, a bunch of sacrifices, trespassings, and that dealt with the individual. It dealt with Israel corporately, and it dealt with the priests on many different days. So I'm saying to myself, there had to be a whole bunch of blood being shed, and there had to be a whole bunch of livestock. I just kind of wanted you to maybe connect that and kind of give me your perspective on that.
Yeah, so in terms of how pervasive the sacrificial system was at that time, there's no question that lots of sacrifices were offered. When you have the dedication of the temple, for example, with Solomon, it's this gala event, but thousands and thousands and thousands of animals were sacrificed. And for sure, the temple in Jerusalem, the time of Jesus, there were sacrifices happening there continually. I don't mean 24/7 necessarily, but constant sacrifices being offered. And then at certain times of the year, when the Jewish people were required to come to Jerusalem three times a year, all the Jewish males. So there'd be a great increase in sacrifices, and obviously there was a message that was being shouted out, which was substitution.
Right.
Substitution. Mm-hmm. Now, some of the sacrifices were for dedicatory purposes, like you were dedicating yourself or someone or something to the Lord. There were sacrifices that were offered for ritual cleansing. There were sacrifices that were offered for certain transgressions. But generally speaking, let's say someone murdered another person, they couldn't come and offer a sacrifice because there was no sacrifice for bloodshed. And then on the Day of Atonement, there would be things that would be covered then in the sacrifices that would not be addressed the rest of the year. So that's why that was the annual Day of Atonement. So obviously, personal repentance was important, and then the sacrifices played a certain role. But it would be wrong to think that every time somebody committed any sin, they had to go offer a sacrifice. Because then there'd be no more livestock in a matter of months. There'd be no more life. I mean, just picture it. You go to the temple to offer your sacrifice because you lied to somebody. And then as you're walking back, you get a bad attitude. Like, man, that's a lot of, I just sinned again with a bad attitude. It would never end. So there were certain purposes for the sacrifices. It was tied in with repentance. The Day of Atonement was very important for national cleansing and atonement of transgressions. And then ultimately, there could not be that same settled sense of assurance of forgiveness that we have. An ancient Israelite could not have had that. Rather, these sacrifices were pointing to something greater. And, of course, that's fulfilled in the coming of the Messiah.
Praise God. Thank you so much, Dr. Mike Brown.
You're very welcome. And thank you for the prayers. Much, much appreciated. As the two of you stood together praying, I do appreciate that very much. 866-348-7884. Let's go over to Joseph in Dallas, Texas. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. I didn't call in too long ago about a related topic, but John Terrell did a couple broadcasts on Sheila Zelinsky recently titled Israel, the Kabbalah, and the Antichrist. And to summarize, he, in my opinion, repeated many Middle Ages slander about the Jewish people. I'll give you just a couple examples of many. He said the protocols of the elders of Zion were not forged. He said Jewish people throughout the ages have had some peculiar, mysterious disease, but didn't actually name the disease itself.
Yikes.
And,
tell me who this is again. You said John Terrell.
John Terrell. Have you heard of him? Or?
It's not ringing a bell. And what was the name of his talk? The Kabbalah?
It was titled Israel, the Kabbalah, and the Antichrist. He did two broadcasts last week on the Sheila Zelinsky radio show.
All right, and the Antichrist. And Sheila Zelinsky, I'm not familiar with either. All right, I'm just looking now. John Terrell, so Torell. No, I've not heard of him, but that is classic anti-Semitism. That is classic anti-Semitic lies. Let's see. He's the founder and president of the European American Evangelistic Crusades, mission organization dedicated to spreading the gospel of Jesus Christ. Been in the ministry for 50 years. So perhaps he's done a lot of good in other ways. But if you're assuming you're quoting this accurately, I see he's got part two of his talk is on the Zionist movement. It would seem that he has bought into some of the standard anti-Semitic libels. So the protocols of the Elders of Zion are a well-known forgery. Russian secret police behind it, based on an earlier French account that alleges that there were these people at a cemetery and they overheard this secret cabal of Jewish leaders plotting world domination, and that basically there are 300 of these Jewish leaders that are waiting to take over the entire world. And of course, because Jews have had in certain countries a disproportionate influence in the media or in banking and things like that, it's like, oh, the Jews control the media, the Jews own all the money. It's a shame that we end up being so persecuted and butchered through all of that. If you're not aware, the protocols of the Elders of Zion actually say that the whole world will be brought into subjection to the Hindu god Vishnu. Yeah, the Hindu god Vishnu. So, Joseph, that's dangerous stuff. I appreciate you bringing it to our attention. And tell you what, we got a break. Stay right there. If you have a further question that I can help you with, we'll do it. Phone lines are lit up. I want to get to as many calls as I can. I've got more to share with you as well today on the Line of Fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. You are tuned in to the right station, the right broadcast right now. Back to Joseph in Dallas, Texas. So I clicked on another link, Joseph, on John Terrell's site, Torell, and it's called the Kabbalah Series, 7 books. Have you ever wondered what motivates the people who make up the world government? What religion do they embrace? In this series of booklets, you will learn how the diabolical Kabbalah, so this is the foundational document or documents of Jewish mysticism, the diabolical Kabbalah was started in the days of Moses. Nonsense! Bogus! More than 5,000 years ago by men who rebelled against God. Complete, 100% bogus nonsense. The secret religion among the 12 tribes of Israel burned like a smoldering fire under the surface, and it was King Solomon who fanned the fire some 900 years before Christ, made into the refined system we see today. Complete, 100% made-up, bogus nonsense. The knowledge you will gain about this evil religion will help you resist the mark of the beast and the oppression that is coming to this earth. May God have mercy on this man for disseminating such serious error. And I'm sure along
the way, he'll
make a point or two that's accurate, but it's basically this idea. And this is what part of what led to the attempted extermination of the European Jews, that they are the evil pariahs, that they are the ones destroying the world. They are the parasites that are seeking to take over the world and destroy it, and they must be eliminated. It's ugly, it's despicable, and it's a shame it's associated with a man in Christian ministry.
Yeah, I completely agree, Dr. Brown. And maybe this is my final comment. Maybe when your schedule permits, you know, someone of your academic credentials could refute this either on Facebook or on part of your Thursday broadcast. I think that would be excellent.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, Joseph, thank you, sir. A lot of this junk has been refuted, but people don't believe facts. They believe myths. They believe internet conspiracies. You know, I went to a traditional university, and they're suppressing all the stuff. These Bible translators are suppressing all the stuff. So sometimes the more facts you bring, the less people believe it. But that, of course, is the nature of deception. The thing is, you know, maybe we can get them to come on the air and lay out his theories for us to demolish then and give him the benefit of our radio audience. Maybe we do that. But there are lots of things, sir. We're constantly asked to address things. If they have very little circulation, generally it's not worth the time to do it, and all we do is expose error to people who hadn't even heard about it. But if it gets more circulation, and some of this is common junk and myths, yeah, it's worth refuting. Hey, thank you. Thank you for the call and the suggestion. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Christy in Richmond, Virginia. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I really enjoy Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I really enjoy this day. I was calling because I had listened to a podcast last night by John MacArthur. I believe it was 1 Corinthians 10:20 about when you sacrifice, as a pagan, when you sacrifice to idols, that you're worshiping demons. And he went on to explain that that would be the same thing as Hindus are worshiping to a demon, and Mormons are worshiping to a demon. But that then he said, and same thing with Jewish people, they're worshiping a demon if they're not worshiping Jesus. And I just wanted you to explain that to me, because I just had a hard time with knowing how much God loves the Jewish people, that they would be worshiping a demon. Could you explain that?
Yeah, well, Paul never said that Jewish people were worshiping demons. He says they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. So a Jewish person is praying to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob when they're praying. They're not praying to Satan. If they're under Satan's power, it's because they're deceived, just like a traditional Catholic that didn't really know the Lord, or a traditional Protestant that didn't really know the Lord, would be deceived. So people can be under demonic power, demonic influence, and if they claim to have all types of mystical experiences, you know, if a Jewish person had a mystical experience in which they heard, you know, the spirit renouncing Jesus as a false Christ, well, that would be demonic, all right?
Right.
But otherwise, a Jewish person praying, look, all they're ever going to pray to is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In other words, when God says to the Jewish people in Deuteronomy 4:29 and Jeremiah 29:13, scattered around the world, if from there you seek me, you'll find me when you seek me with all your heart, with all your soul. What are they going to do? They're going to cry out to God. And when they rightly understand who Jesus is as the Messiah, then they'll be rightly connected to God. As I wrote years ago, it's a matter of being so near and yet so far. For a religious Jew praying, look at the Jewish prayer book. It's filled with psalms. It's filled with quotations of scripture. It's filled with petitions. Some of the petitions reflect the Lord's Prayer, that the Lord's Prayer in Matthew 6 takes on the language of some traditional Jewish prayers and modifies and adapts it accordingly. So if you talk about someone who's an idol worshiper, right, who's bowing down before a statue of a monkey god, and or if you talk about, say, Muslims who are gathering together during Ramadan for some special impartation of divine power. And one of my former students who had ministered in Morocco, talked about what it was like living there and seeing this and how demonic it was, you know, this reception of some kind of power. That's a whole other thing. Joseph Smith getting his false revelation, from allegedly from an angel. Well, if he did encounter an angel, it was not a holy angel. It was demonic. That we understand. But I would certainly not say that of the Jewish people. So again, John MacArthur's explicit statement about demons, how far did he take that as far as Israel and the Jewish people?
Well, I can't say for sure today. I just remember hearing it last night, and the scripture says something about, and again, 1 Corinthians 10:20. I went home and read it just to see if I was understanding it right, and it said, if you're making a sacrifice that's not to Jesus, then you're making a sacrifice to demons. And so for the Jewish people, I always assume...
Right. So you were raising that question. Pastor MacArthur, I just wanted to be clear for our listeners. Pastor MacArthur didn't say that if a Jewish person is praying to God, they're actually praying to a demon. He didn't make that statement, correct?
Correct.
Right, yeah. So again, it's in the context of worshiping other deities, false gods.
Right.
What's the power behind them? Why are people drawn to them? Are there some types of experiences they have? Well, it could be, but it's by demonic power. And that's another reason for the prohibition of idols, that it brings people under a power other than the power of God, a deceptive power, a destructive power. And worship must be directed towards the one true God and to him alone. Hey, Christy, I appreciate the question. All right, friends, stay right there. We've got 30 minutes to go, and I want to try to get to every one of you on the line right now. I want to get to as many calls as possible. So stay right there. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown here, delighted to be with you. I want to take as many calls in the next half hour as I possibly can. I want to make a few comments first. While in Singapore, I had a private meeting with Joseph Prince. That was this past Friday, so 6 days ago. We spent 2.5 hours together. We agreed that the meeting would be private, not announced, but we also agreed that should we feel is a statement we can issue, we can talk about our agreements in the midst of our differences, that we would do that. I subsequently wrote an article. Joseph Prince then sent it back with his edits. I then sent it back with mine. We came to full agreement of every line in the article, and you can read it now. It's gone viral on the charismanews.com website in the last 4 hours or so, shared 11,000 plus times. One interesting thing with Pastor Prince that I knew he had a love for Israel, but he has a tremendous desire and burden to see Jewish people saved, of course, as I do. And our areas of agreement far, far, far outweigh and outshine our areas of disagreement. That's what we talk about in this article. So read it, share it with others. But on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, I thought I'd mention it. It was relevant. One other thing I want to say is this. The women's march that took place this past weekend, the protest march against Donald Trump, and more protests being planned, people have every right to protest, peaceful protests. It's part of our national history and part of First Amendment rights. People can express their differences. That's part of our nation, and it's fine. And you might think that some of what people are saying is stupid or idiotic. That's fine. They may think what I'm saying is stupid or idiotic, but we're allowed to do that. What I differ with, obviously the spirit and tone of some of what's said, the ugliness of some of the speeches, the violence of some of the speeches, the radical feminism, you're not going to have pro-life people there. Even if they wanted, even if they had issues with Donald Trump and folks, misogynist or whatever, in fact, your marriage, they wouldn't have been welcome. Pro-life people would not have been welcome. But one of my other issues is Muslim feminists, some of the alleged ties to groups like Hamas, what are they doing? At how are you going to call yourself a Muslim feminist with ties to radical Islam? From what I read in Berlin, women's protest march against Trump in Berlin, there were women chanting Allahu Akbar. How's that work? How's that work? Isn't there much oppression of women in Islamic countries? Honor killings, things like that. Under the Taliban in Afghanistan, women couldn't get education, can't drive a car if you're a woman in Saudi Arabia, all types of restrictions. I'm sure some of the women, you know, feel covered and protected and love the Islamic religion. I understand that. And there are varieties of the Islamic faith in terms of its expression. I understand all that. But when you have some of these people involved with these Islamic connections and they're protesting Trump's alleged misogyny, I have an issue with that. So I'm looking at this story on the Daily Caller from January 21st. Women's March organizer recently met ex-Hamas operative, has family ties to terror group. Now, I don't want to go on a witch hunt here, but I think there's validity to this. Linda Sarsour, one of the organizers behind Saturday's Women's March being held in Washington, D.C., was recently spotted at a large Muslim convention in Chicago posing for pictures with an accused financier for Hamas, the terrorist group. Sarsour, the head of the Arab American Association of New York and an Obama White House champion of change, was speaking at last month's 15th annual convention of the Muslim American Society and Islamic Circle of North America. And while there, she posed for a picture with Salah Sarsour, a member of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee and former Hamas operative who was jailed in the 1990s because of his alleged work for the terrorist group. How closely connected is she with them? I don't know. I'll just say this. It's a bit hypocritical. It's a bit hypocritical to be saying Allahu Akbar and protesting Donald Trump's alleged misogyny. We'll be right back.
God of light, hear our cry, send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. When you hear those passionate cries, those passionate voices from traditional Jews who are not believers in Jesus, the Messiah, pray that the God who loves them dearly would reveal himself in full to them. Certainly, they say they want to know God. They live to know God and God alone. Pray that he would make himself known and that they would understand the truth about Jesus, the Messiah. 866-34-TRUTH. Hey, our book, Breaking the Stronghold of Food by God's Grace, is doing better than any book I've ever written. Of course, that's because Nancy's in on this one. It's about food. But we're getting great, great reports. If you haven't yet posted your review on Amazon, please do it. If the book has blessed you, if you post your review, that may help 5, 10, 15, 100 other people will see it and say, wow, I'm encouraged by that, and get the book, and they will be helped as well. So remember to post your review on Amazon.com. And if you haven't ordered it yet, of course, you can order right there or from our own website, 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Bryant in Ohio. Welcome to the Land of Fire. Line of Fire. I'm looking at land, thinking land. Welcome to the Line of Fire, not the Land of Fire. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Because that recent resolution that the UN had regarding Jerusalem as being not a part of Israel, what do you suppose the likelihood, or what's your opinion of Israel annexing both Samaria and Judea, to prove a point, if nothing else?
Well, right now, Judea, Samaria, the so-called West Bank, what the world calls occupied territory, that is part of Israel right now. That is part of Israel, as is East Jerusalem. That UN resolution, in part of that resolution against building more settlements, also said by default, really explicitly, that all the so-called occupied territories are not actually belonging to Israel. Well, of course they are. So that's the issue. Israel has control over those areas. The Palestinian Authority is allowed to govern Judea, Samaria, the so-called West Bank, that's meaning the West Bank of the Jordan River, and Hamas governs Gaza Strip. All right, but Israel owns and controls all that and has annexed it. With the Six-Day War in 1967, Israel then took that territory and has kept that territory, but it's largely inhabited by Palestinians. Now, through the settlements, the number of Jews living there has grown and grown, and people say, yeah, you're making a two-state solution impossible. Well, you could have it if the Jews were happy to live under Palestinian leadership. Hamas, there are no Jews there. They're out. So Hamas just controls the Gaza Strip. That's just by itself in that regard. But yeah, it's been annexed in terms of it's in the Six-Day War that happened. Now, what you're saying is just say, hey, forget the two-state solution. It's just all one state. We're ruling over it. That is part of the discussion. And as long as Jews were convinced that they would have a majority population, then they could continue to have the majority government and the nation could continue to be a Jewish state by majority. But how that would work out, there are many, many questions with it. Hey, thank you, sir, for the call. Oh, by the way, for sure, Israel has gotten even more aggressive with building of settlements, or that would be the plan to do that as a result of kind of a pushback against the UN resolution and America's betrayal of Israel in the midst of that. And thankfully, Donald Trump has been on the opposite side of that, on a pro-Israel position. I appreciate the call. Thank you. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Bellini in Greensboro. Welcome back to the Line of Fire. Hello, you're on the air. Guess you're not there. I did remember the name, though. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Michael in San Antonio, Texas. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Doctor. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, sir.
Yes, sir. Good to talk to you again, Dr. Brown. I've called you before when I was living in Corpus Christi. Dr. Brown, can you put to rest? I don't think you'll ever put to rest, but this myth that everybody's saying, even my sister, unfortunately, is in the religion, that she believes that the true Israelite, the true Jews are blacks. And you know, she's saying that Israel today, those people in Israel, the Jewish people, shouldn't be, they don't belong there, that it should be all the blacks living in that land. And I'm thinking, it raises questions. So what does that mean? Hitler killed the wrong people?
Oh, yeah. Hey, listen, when I debated some black Hebrew Israelites in the streets of New York City in the early 1990s, I failed to realize that I was the only white person in the crowd, along with a colleague of mine, Ron Cantor, who you can see along with me on God TV on a regular basis. He broadcasts from Israel. But when I challenged these guys and their theology and yelled out a warning that we need each other, that these men are preaching a religion of hate, Jesus preached a religion of love, I forgot that I was the only white person along with my colleague in the crowd there. So suddenly the crowd began to chant, "Death to America! Death to the white man!" So, that's just a fringe group. You've got whites who hate blacks. You have blacks who hate whites. So you've got, you know, these ugly fringes everywhere. But there is, that's one question I asked them. So Hitler killed the wrong people. He said, no, Hitler knew the blacks that were Jews. Come on, nonsense. So here's the deal. Historically, we can trace movements of people that were in the land of Israel, that were then scattered in nations, that Jews can trace their lineages, okay? This has been over through the centuries. We have archaeological data. We have linguistic data. We have literature, the books that were written, the things that were left behind, all of this. So we know, okay, people lived in this country, then they moved over to this country. They've been scattered here, now brought back here. So it's not like this is hidden somewhere. You know, you've got to find some time capsule. We have this historically. We know
they were not Negro. We know they were not Negro featured.
Right. They would have been Middle Eastern. They would have been more brown than black. I
believe Menelik, you know, Menelik, the son of Solomon, and Sheba, I believe he was half black. Therefore, yeah, the Ethiopian Jews. I buy that.
Right. That's the is that the origin of Ethiopian Jews? That's their tradition. And of course, Haile Selassie and these others would have claimed to be, you know, descended from Solomon and Sheba and things like that, the Queen of Sheba. But you can see, for example, in Egyptian iconography, so these ancient inscriptions with, you know, with the full pictures and things like that, you can see the Egyptians and their Nubian slaves. And the Nubians were Africans. Okay, so Egypt is North Africa. The Nubians were a darker-skinned people with Negroid features as opposed to the Egyptians. Studies have been done because of the various remains on skull size, and you could see a difference in skull size from the Egyptians, from the Nubians and others. So the Israelites would have been a darker-skinned people, like Middle Eastern people today, all right? But not black and not Caucasian. Whatever the color was, I could care less. But we're just talking about reality. Now, here's another thing. Jews then, scattered around the world, there'd be a lot of intermarriage. And the only intermarriage that would last would be if someone married into the Jewish people. When you marry out of the Jewish people, you assimilate and you're lost to the nation. So when you have people continuing to live as Jews that are in different nations and now take on the characteristics of those nations, that means the intermarriage is coming in. People are marrying a woman, a Jewish, a Gentile woman is marrying a Jewish man and becoming part of the Jewish family. So hence you'll have some of these mixtures. But if you'll trace DNA back, for example, descendants of Levi, they may have a last name of Cohen, which is Kohen priest or Levi. Many of them do. But there's a common DNA that goes back to the Middle East and is ostensibly traceable back to Aaron. And then you have, for example, in Song of Solomon, Song of Songs, the woman saying, I'm black and beautiful, I'm dark, but she says, don't look down at me because the sun has burned me. So she's not saying this is my normal skin color, but I'm darkened by the sun. So you have a Middle Eastern person darkened by the sun, that's dark. You also have references to in the Lamentations that the princes of Israel were white as snow. If you're going to try to make these silly arguments, you know, even Revelation 1, they say, well, his hair was like, you know, like wool. It doesn't say it looked like the image there is white like wool is the biggest thing. And then face like burnished bronze, bronze in the fire. Bronze in the fire glows very whitish. So the argument actually works against it. So there was zero, 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 zero evidence that the ancient Israelites were black. Zero. Were they darker skinned than me as a white man? Yes. Were they lighter skinned than, say, a Nigerian African? Yes. And it's the whole anti-Semitic lie, Michael. This is the heart of it, that the people living in Israel don't deserve to be there. That's what it comes down to. Another way to reject the personhood of the people of Israel and the promises God made to them. Thank you for the call.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on the Line of Fire. Yeah, former UN ambassador and at one point Secretary of State candidate John Bolton was on SiriusXM with Alex Marlowe yesterday, and he said it's easy to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. You just move the sign from one building to another. Say, this is our embassy, and then you can build it up. You can build a bigger embassy, the full-scope embassy, obviously over a longer period of time, but you could make the dramatic move quickly. I read an article where Palestinian leaders say that the Trump administration assured them that they're not going to be moving the embassy there. I believe that's completely bogus. And John Bolton is concerned that, you know, Donald Trump is doing so much amazingly, so quickly, and yet he's not doing this yet. Well, from everything I heard, it's going to be months down the line before this move is made. I don't think it's in jeopardy at all. Personally, I think this is one of the things he said he's going to do, that he is going to do. Let us go to Shane in Hagerstown, Maryland. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. My question is, 2 days ago, I witnessed a gentleman die in a car accident. The family had called me and invited me to the funeral of this gentleman. They are Jewish, and I was just wondering, because there's apparently like a three-day something. I can't remember, not a wake, but I guess like a Jewish equivalent to a wake. And I wanted to take a gift of condolence. So I'm not exactly sure. Is there something that I could give them to kind of, because I did pray that maybe God could use this to you know, to show him, you know. So I don't want to go with like the wrong thing, and I don't want to be.
Yeah, no, I appreciate ignorant. That. That's remarkable that you were invited. You know, what you're talking about is what's called sitting Shiva. Shiva is the Shiva, the Hebrew number 7, and in Jewish tradition, when someone has died, when they die, you bury them within 24 hours, unless it's the Sabbath. You bury them within 24 hours. So it's intense, it's traumatic. But then for a week afterwards, people come to your home, friends, relatives, just to spend time together, to offer condolences, to share memories and things like that, and to just try to keep you busy, keep you with people around. You don't have to cook or think of anything like that. So you don't want to bring a gift. What you want to bring is some food. Maybe cold cuts, maybe some pastries, things like that. If it's cold cuts, just make sure it's not bacon or something like that.
Right. All right.
But, you know, if it is cold cuts, I don't know if they're a religious family, but you could just make sure they're kosher or ask about that. But otherwise, just some pastries, something like that would be fine. And then you're just there to be a gracious person. It's not the time to be witnessing. It's that,
right,
you know, that,
right.
That would be an intrusion. But just to be yourself, and it's again, it's extraordinary that you've been invited. So you don't want to bring a gift, but you want to go yourself, and you want to just seek to bring some level of you know, joy or something. You know, depends on the atmosphere that's there when you get there. And then, like I said, just people are bringing food, and the reason is that the mourners don't have to think about cooking for a week. That everything they need has been brought to them, and it's just fellowship and that kind of distraction. So that's what you want to do, okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, sir. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Patrick in San Francisco. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hello, thank you. I've got a question relating to Deuteronomy 27 and 28, where it lists these curses. And is there a dividing line where we can say that these apply to the nation of Israel and the covenant that they have with the Lord, and these apply to everyone else? And also, how do those relate directly to Galatians 3:13? I'm looking, I suppose, for a clear definition of what is the curse of the law.
Yes, sir. All right, so on the one hand, there are blessings that are reiterated through Scripture that come through obedience and faith, all right? So there's a reward for generosity. We reap what we sow. We sow in love towards others. God blesses that. But then there were specific promises under the law. We're not under that. We're not under the blessings and curses of the Sinai covenant. In fact, every blessing has been secured for us in Jesus the Messiah, in particular every heavenly blessing. And the penalty for rejecting the Messiah is worse than the penalty for rejecting the law of Moses, as is reiterated in the book of Hebrews, especially chapters 2, 10, and 12. And Hebrews 10 saying, if people died without mercy at the testimony of two or three witnesses under the law of Moses, how much worse punishment for the one that knew the Son of God was sanctified by his blood and rejected him. Or Hebrews 12, don't refuse the one who speaks from heaven. If they didn't escape who refused the one who spoke on earth, much less if they refuse the one who speaks from heaven. So the curse of the law is the curse of judgment for disobedience. It is that if I fall short, then the judgments of God will come on me. So the curse of law is not that the law is a curse. The law itself is holy, just, and good. The law is beautiful, and reflects truths about God and his character. But the curse of the law is the curses for disobedience, summed up as the curse of the law. And cursed is everyone who disobeys. That's the curse of the law. And that we have been freed from, because otherwise we all fall short. Otherwise we'll all be judged. Otherwise we'll all be damned. The reason that Israel has been scattered around the world for centuries is because we kept disobeying God as Jewish people. And we've been brought back not because of our obedience, but because of God's gracious purposes to restore for his end time plan to unfold. So the Messiah has redeemed us from the curse of the law. And of course, he quotes directly from Deuteronomy 27. And to sum it up, when you get to the end of Deuteronomy 27, anyone who does not put the words of this law into practice is cursed. That's the curse of the law. The summary is right there. And that's what Paul says we have been redeemed from. So we receive mercy no matter what we've done, no matter how far we have fallen short. We receive mercy in the Messiah. And now, by his grace, we are empowered to live a holy life. And where we fall short, we turn in repentance and ask for cleansing and continue to move forward in the Lord. And God forbid we entertain the notion of rejecting the one who purchased our mercy. The penalty for that is far greater than the penalty under the law of Moses. That reminds me that you may want to read the article on my meeting with Pastor Joseph Prince. Check it out at thelineoffire.org. And while you're there, you'll see a grace-related resource offer. It just works out like that. I think you'll be blessed and helped by it. All right, friends, out of time. Be back with your questions tomorrow. My bottom line today: thank God for the grace and mercy extended to us. If we were judged by the works of the law, we'd all fall short.